Our final case for this morning is United States against Marcus Kilgore. Mr. Benvenides. We'll just do a circle around the table, Mr. Benvenides.
Good morning, Your Honors and Counsel. I'm Attorney Ronald Benavides, appearing on behalf of Marcus Kilgore. It's essentially a felon in possession case, and I would assert that the crux of the case is this. In the context of the case law, the well-established case law of the cases cited, such as Mihalik, Perez, Lane, Burks, Hendricks, and so on, what is the duration of the imminent threat that Marcus Kilgore faced and responded to? It's fairly clear that the cases refer to concepts that are fairly consistent in the heat of the moment, in response to an imminent threat to protect, to avoid death for himself or harm to himself or others. A felon can possess a gun for that moment, while that imminent threat lasts. He can't possess it before or after, and he can only do so if he's exhausted all legal means prior to taking possession. So the question is, what is the duration of the imminent threat? It's fair to say that the court, the district court, and the government had the theory that there may have been one point in this incident where there was an imminent threat, and that's when Marcus disarmed his brother Prentice after Prentice had shot himself. There was the prior incident of a shooting, but the thing that took place in the apartment when Marcus disarmed his brother, the theory below was that that was it, possibly. I would assert on his behalf that that was the beginning point on a continuum, that the imminent threat extended in time, and that the first point, the initial point, was his disarming his intoxicated brother, but that that continued. And during that extended incident, he had actual and constructive possession, depending on what he was responding to, what phase of the imminent threat he was responding to. When he first responded to Prentice, Marcus had been in the bathroom, and he heard the shot. When he first came out, he could not have known what was in Prentice's mind. He says at sentencing that he was the one who took the initiative to disarm his brother, who was intoxicated. He could not have known if his brother intended to harm himself or others. So what he did after disarming him, and I would assert this is where the next point of the continuum extends, he put himself between his brother and the gun. He did so in the bathroom, tending to his bleeding brother, and Marcus next to him, tending to him, the gun on the counter. He checked that gun. He believed that it had been, he had unloaded it or removed all bullets and casings. It turned out there were still two bullets in there. But that's what he was doing. That's what he continued to do. And I would assert as well, I would point out that the result of his action over some time, over the course of an hour, is that no one else was hurt, no other shot was fired, nobody else handled the gun until the very end.
I think the district court was motivated by the surrounding circumstances of the incident, which demonstrated a motivation to get rid of the gun as evidence of the prior shooting as much as it was to disarm his brother and keep him from hurting himself or others. And that's what seems to have motivated or moved Judge Crabb to deny the motion to withdraw the plea and reject the justification defense as a basis for that.
She was referring to a disputed point. It was disputed.
I thought even accepting your client's story, which was that he gave it to
Pennington,
and told her to get rid of it. That's his best evidence.
She said
it's
that
not
that
very
was
good for him.
More characteristic of somebody trying to protect his brother, keeping the gun from being discovered by the police. That's the comment the court made.
Right. And I mean, that's the best spin on these facts for him, and that's not such a great spin.
I would call that the final point of this continuum. It was once his brother was in the car on the way to the hospital after having been convinced, Kilgore finally got rid of it. He took it out. He says he gave it to Pennington. Do something with this. If you accept what Pennington says and he threw it in the snowbank, that's a reckless act. Perhaps you could call it a stupid act. But nonetheless,
it's also an act of unjustified possession, and that's the issue.
But let me ask you this question. Do you think this durational point that you're making is a question of fact? Do you think it's a question of law? Do you think the district court decides that at some point, looking at the facts in the light most favorable to Mr. Kilgore, you know, let's say accepting the idea that he gives the gun to Pennington when they go outside and there's not much that's disputed, but give him those disputes. Is it a legal characterization of what it takes for the justification defense, or is it a factual characterization about duration?
I see it in a dual manner. I don't think the case law prohibits this concept of a durational type imminent threat. Normally, there's reference to in the heat of the moment or at a particular moment somebody can grab a gun. But there's nothing in the case.
The district court could say, you know, after fill in the blank, you know, 30 minutes, an hour, it's just too long to satisfy imminency, and that's all there is to it as a matter of law. You would never let a jury decide such a case.
Most of the cases referred to in the sets of briefs that were presented have much longer duration. Somebody possessing a gun months after a threat took place, having immediate recourse to a gun or throwing a gun out the window and so on. But this appears to be an instance that doesn't come up very often where something is happening and there are adults and children present. Kilgore's father said at the sentencing, thank God he was there. Who knows what would have happened. I don't believe that there would be a bright line rule after 35 minutes or 2 hours that theoretically under the circumstances there could be a threat that continues. And I think it's fair to say that's what happened here. And it is a fact, it seems that it was overlooked by the court, that nobody else was hurt once Kilgore took action. I'll just, if I may, make one other point. I may be able to save the court some time. This concept of the underlying chaos, I believe, was underlooked by the court as well. The court concluded, you're just trying to help your brother. You're acting like a criminally minded person. But nonetheless, there had to be a kind of chaos in operation in this incident, and that's the context in which Kilgore makes the decision. And secondly, I think it's fair to say the district court did not look at that fact or factor under 18 U.S.C. 3553A. There was reference to 5K2.12, coercion as a mitigating factor. The court may depart downward, but there was no specific reference to the 18 U.S.C. 3553A, where Kilgore may have saved lives. So those are the points.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Rumbelow.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Rita Rumbelow. I represented this case in district court below. What Mr. Benavides' argument overlooks is the fact that Marcus Kilgore knew that his brother Prentice was armed the entire day of January 30th, 2008. In fact, he knew that Prentice Kilgore had directed several women, to purchase ammunition for him just prior to that. Marcus Kilgore was with his brother Prentice, and he saw Prentice shoot Danny Turner. At no time during any of this was Marcus Kilgore fearful for his own safety at the hands of his brother Prentice.
He also helped him escape the scene.
Exactly. I mean, the facts of this case are
pretty aggravated. Was he charged in state court with aider and abetter liability to the shooting?
No, and in fact, he couldn't even get an enhancement under the sentencing guidelines for harboring a fugitive because it was his relative, and there's an exception for that under the Wisconsin state statutes, believe it or not. Very troubling. So Marcus clearly was not fearful for his own safety, and to suggest that after Prentice Kilgore accidentally shot himself, that there was danger then presented to Jesse Pennington and these minor children who were sleeping on the floor of this apartment just doesn't have any merit. That argument just doesn't fly. Marcus Kilgore and Judge Crabb, it's correct. There's no other inference to draw from the facts of this case. He took the gun from Prentice only after Prentice shot himself. That's fine. But then, why didn't he hand it to Jesse Pennington then? Why not then? Oh, no, he keeps it. He takes, by his own admission, he removed the empty shell casings from this revolver, the empty shell casing that tied his brother to the attempted homicide of Danny Turner. He takes the time to do that. And then they're in this apartment for an entire hour. Marcus Kilgore doesn't even call the police at that point, doesn't call an ambulance. Instead, he calls different women who he think may have some sort of medical ability to aid Prentice's or to help Prentice with his wound. I mean, was it chaotic? Probably only because Marcus is the one who called additional people to the apartment. And then Judge Crabb was absolutely correct, as Judge Sykes noted. He was motivated to destroy the evidence. That's the only explanation for removing this revolver from that apartment, because
well,
there was
and
another.
And I guess that's where I would just want to say, I think the district court's job in such cases, I mean, this is certainly the government's characterization of these facts, but the district court's job in all such cases is to assess the facts that have been put on the table and see if those facts would support submitting the defense to a jury, right?
Absolutely.
So, and she is looking at this set of facts and saying, given the duration, given, as you point out, the surrounding circumstances, any jury that found justification would be acting lawlessly, I mean, you know, however you want to put it. So it's her job, I think, in a very basic legal sufficiency sense. She's not really finding the facts. She's not saying, yes, you're justified, no, you're not. She needs to be one step back, I think.
Right, but in this particular case, the facts were not in dispute at all. So it was actually...
Aside from just this one minor point about whether he tosses it into the snowbank or whether Pennington does.
So here it was actually then easy for the district court to make those factual findings without having to take a step back because they were just undisputed. Mm-hmm. And the defendant, again, made numerous statements. Every statement was the same as the previous statement. They were handwritten statements. He described everything that he did.
Well, there's one other layer of review here, which is that this argument is being put forward in the context of a motion to withdraw a guilty plea, right?
Right.
And
yes,
so he's
based
admitted
on legal
his
innocence.
Guilt. He's waived his rights to assert any available defense, including a justification defense. He's done so on the record.
We allowed him to do a conditional guilty plea pursuant to it. We had done it in one other case, United States versus Haynes, because at the initial plea hearing, even then, defendant Kilgore tried to tell the district court, but wait, I only possessed it because, you know, I was justified to do so. In his mind, he clearly just can't get past this. So we said, okay, if we don't think you're legally innocent, the district court has held you're not legally innocent, you're not entitled to present this defense at trial, but if you need to hear it from the Court of Appeals too, fine, we'll let you enter into a conditional guilty plea and, you know, reserve your right to appeal on this issue. But by removing the handgun from the apartment and trying to destroy the evidence, he was not facing an imminent threat. Others were not facing an imminent threat. Prentice Kilgore was in a completely separate car on his way to the hospital. So the district court did correctly find that he was not entitled to present a justification defense at trial. And as for the reasonableness of his sentence, the district court gave him the low end of the guideline range of 92 to 115 months. There was absolutely no basis for a downward variance. This defendant has been in trouble with the law since the age of 11. His tendencies to commit violent acts towards elderly people, make threats to law enforcement officers, and so many other things just did not warrant a downward variance under any factor under 3553A or under any section 5K of the guidelines. Nothing at all warranted a downward variance. So I ask that this court affirm the judgment and conviction of the district court. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. Anything further, Mr. Benavides?
The final point, Your Honor, is that Judge Crabb gave a list of options, as in, occurs in some of the other cases. Judge Posner gives some options in Perez that that defendant could have stayed in the apartment instead of being worried about being robbed on the way to the bank. But one thing that happens by Kilgore acting in the way that he did and by not handing the gun immediately to somebody else or putting it on a shelf is that no one else is hurt and no other shots are fired. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And you took this case by appointment, did you not?
Yes, I did.
We thank you very much for your assistance to the court and to your client. And thank you as well, Ms. Rumbleau. The case will be taken under advisement, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning.